We have to make sure that the promises we make in Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare are promises we can keep. And there are various ways of doing that. One is we could raise taxes on people. That's not the way. Corporations are people, my friend.
When Mitt Romney insisted that corporations are people, my friend, he met with some derision, and yet corporations are indeed composed of people, and a corporation has many of the same rights that an individual has. Why have the legal rights of corporations become so controversial? I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air. What's the traditional role of corporations in America's communities, and how has it changed over the years? What does the U.S. Constitution have to say about the status of corporations? What are the political and social repercussions if corporations have the rights of individuals? Answering those and other questions is our guest, Paul Boyer, Professor of History Emeritus at the UW-Madison. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you very much, Norman.
Now, you know, you are a man of many parts. You have diverse interests. You've talked to us about Bible issues. You talked to us about the Salem witch trials. This would seem to be a little apart from your other interests. What grounds you in this idea of thinking about corporations?
Well, that's a good point. I'm not a legal or constitutional historian, and I'm not a business historian. My focus has been on American cultural history. But I'm interested in it as a historian, this question, and also I have some personal experiences, I guess, that have sort of drawn me to this question of how corporations fit into our society. I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, and Dayton, Ohio was the home of a company called the National Cash Register Company. Founded in 1884, made a useful product. It was a register that was used in businesses, and when the clerk wanted to ring up a sale, he would press a button and a bell would go ka-ching, so everyone knew the cash drawer was being opened. So it cut down on petty theft and also created a kind of adventure of purchasing a product. So cash registers really caught on, and they were based in Dayton. They were manufactured in Dayton. And as I was growing up, I heard stories of the sort of corporate benevolence that the National Cash Register Company, or the Cash, or NCR as it was called, had given to the city of Dayton, particularly at the time of a terrible flood in 1913. The founder of NCR, a man named Robert Patterson, ordered emergency boats built, which literally went into the flooded areas and picked up people, including my father and his grandfather and other members of his family who had punched a hole in the roof and were waiting rescue on the roof. And then when I graduated from high school in the 50s, my graduating class, like many other high school graduating classes in Dayton, performed this ceremony in the National Cash Register Auditorium, which was a civic building open for public events of all kinds. And this was part of a pattern of corporate philanthropy in the city of Dayton that made NCR really – it was felt to be a part of the community. Now, I don't want to romanticize this. Colonel Patterson, as he was called, was a kind of typical corporate tycoon of the late 19th century. He squeezed off competitors. He was convicted or at least was accused of violating the antitrust laws. But in the city of Dayton, as I was growing up, NCR and Colonel Patterson were viewed as very much a part of the fabric of the community. And that changed dramatically, and it was part of that change that drew my interest to this question of how corporations are fitting into our modern life.
Well, it must have been a pattern that was repeated many times over in the country in the late 19th century, early 20th century, to have a major company that would be a major employer and a major benefactor to a specific community.
Absolutely, it did. What happened with NCR was they became a multinational corporation. They gradually moved out of Dayton. This was driven home for me in 1996 when I picked up the New York Times one morning. And there on the front page was a headline, "A Hometown Feels Less Like Home." And there was a photograph of the NCR auditorium where I had graduated high school being demolished, this wreck of a building. And it symbolized the fact that NCR had pulled up its roots from Dayton. It was a major multinational with the interests in Scotland and India. And the corporate headquarters eventually moved to Atlanta. So this symbolized in a way, in a personal way for me, what you describe, and that is the kind of changes that have occurred in the role of corporations, the role of businesses in American life, evolving from locally based, rooted operations that seem to have a strong sense of local civic obligation to kind of impersonal multinational entities that can move anywhere. And I was particularly struck by a passage in a book by a historian named Christopher Lash. It was at the University of Rochester. 1995, just about the time this New York Times article appeared about NCR, Lash published a book called The Revolt of the Elites and the Betrayal of Democracy. And maybe it's worth reading a really short passage from his book. "Old families were once recognizable as such. They put down roots. Their insistence on the sanctity of private property was qualified by the principle that wealth involved civic obligations. Libraries, museums, parks, orchestras, universities, hospitals, and other civic amenities stood as so many monuments to upper-class munificence. These days, advancement in business requires a willingness to follow opportunity wherever it leads. A migratory way of life is the price of getting ahead. The new corporate elite are more concerned with the smooth functioning of the system as a whole than with any of its parts. Their loyalties are international rather than regional, national, or local. They have more in common with their counterparts in Brussels or Hong Kong than with the masses of Americans." So that was Christopher Lash's description of this kind of change we're talking about.
Well, you get the impression that, as you say, Paul, the bottom line was always the driving force for these corporations, although if they were plenty in the black, then they could afford to build an auditorium in Dayton. But they had to do certain things that would be considered, dog-eat-dog in order to get that bottom line. And nothing has changed there, even when these corporations go multinational.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I would readily acknowledge that. And in the case of NCR, for example, their local philanthropy very much served their corporate interest, building public goodwill, getting them an advantage when they sought certain legislation that favored them. It was an anti-union corporation, so they built parks and for the workers. They had medical clinics. Colonel Patterson had a medical clinic at NCR. It was a clean, well-lighted, bright sort of workplace, but it ultimately did serve the interests of the corporation. I really don't want to kind of sentimentalize the past and suggest that some kind of totally new dynamic has evolved here. But changes have come with the enormous growth of corporations, and particularly the multinational globalization of corporations. What was a kind of rootedness and a kind of commitment to local communities, whatever the motive, I think really has diminished significantly in recent decades.
So the concept of a corporation as a citizen of a community has gone by the wayside, as the corporation might outsource not only to another community but to another country.
Absolutely. When I Googled NCR the other day, I thought maybe in Atlanta they had built a stadium or something. Well, there is an NCR stadium, but it's now in New Delhi. Their corporate philanthropy now is directed in that area.
Does it overall become somehow less tangible, this philanthropy, when the corporation like NCR is all over the globe?
It does. And corporate philanthropy continues. A classic example in our own day is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, now reinforced by Warren Buffett's fortune, which is doing very significant work in the field of public health and disease throughout the world, particularly the developing world. So it still continues, but that's a good point. I mean, no particular community feels that it's benefiting from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or the Microsoft fortune that it's based on. So that transformation has occurred as well. And also corporations have become very skillful at a kind of public relations form of identifying with communities. So in Milwaukee, we have Miller Park, Miller Brewing, now part of a multinational corporation based in England, but they paid $40 million, I believe, to get naming rights to Miller Park. So there's a kind of symbolic link to the community that doesn't really translate into very much in terms of tangible benefit, but still keeps the name Miller alive in Milwaukee.
Does that apply also to the flip side, if a corporation is liable for a problem?
Well, that raises, I think, a very interesting question that would get us into a bit of history. While corporations have become increasingly sort of rootless and global, under American law, there is a very strong legal tradition now that corporations are people. And my sort of curiosity about all of this led me to look at the origins of this. And actually, it goes back to the 14th Amendment, which was passed in 1867 in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War and emancipation. And a crucial clause in the 14th Amendment reads, "No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law." Well, this was passed, of course, at the end of slavery, and it was passed to guarantee the civil rights, due process, and so on, of the freedmen, the former slaves, who under the slave codes of the southern states had been denied all of these rights. Now, ironically, the 14th Amendment didn't really achieve its purpose, at least for a long time. It was widely ignored, and particularly in the South, African Americans were, in fact, denied basic civil rights. But an interesting thing happened, and that is in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a series of decisions, extended the rights of the 14th Amendment, which were extended to persons, defined corporations as persons.
Now, that seems like a jump to me.
It was a big jump, but the along the lines of Mitt Romney's thinking, corporations are simply groups of people. Therefore, the rights extended to individual persons under the 14th Amendment also extend to these groups of people known as corporations. So state legislation that attempted to outlaw child labor, for example, or regulate working conditions in factories, these were held to be unconstitutional in a number of cases by the courts on the basis of this 14th Amendment clause that no person may be denied the equal coverage of the law. So this was a crucial step that was made by the courts in the late 19th, early 20th century, extending the terms of the 14th Amendment to protect corporations from efforts by state legislatures to regulate their behavior.
It would seem that you could apply that same logic to almost any group of people with a common interest then, whether it was in business or some other, you know, line of endeavor.
It one would think that, but in fact, given the climate of the time, it was the business. It was corporate business interests, which of course were important political influences then, as they are today, that primarily benefited from this move by the courts.
And how did the benefits start to accrue then for corporations once they were recognized to have the same rights, same constitutional protections as individuals?
The benefits, the interest, the corporate interests were served in a number of ways. In the so-called progressive era, when states were attempting to protect the rights of workers and so on, the law was interpreted to challenge those laws. More recently, in fact, just this past year, a very important, very interesting Supreme Court case came along that grows directly out of this tradition. And this is the case of Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission.
And Citizens United is what kind of organization exactly?
Citizens United was a nonprofit corporation funded by some very wealthy corporate interests, set up basically to influence the outcome of elections. And in one particularly – the case that actually lies at the heart of the ruling, Citizens United funded a movie, a film that was widely shown on television attacking Hillary Clinton at a time when she was a serious presidential candidate in 2008, and they were sued on the grounds that action violated the so-called McCain-Feingold
campaign finance law,
which prohibited in specific ways corporate contributions and involvement in elections within 30 days of the election. Well, the case made its way through the lower courts and eventually reached the Supreme Court, and the ruling came down early in 2010. And a divided court, so many decisions these days are very closely divided, 5-4, the court held that the rights, the constitutional rights of this corporation, Citizens United, had been violated by the fines that were imposed on them. And in the course of the decision, the court, the 5-4 majority, ruled that key provisions of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law were unconstitutional. And in the majority decision written by Justice Kennedy, this key phrase is found: if the First Amendment has any force, it prohibits Congress from fining or jailing citizens or associations of citizens for simply engaging in political speech. The key phrase there is or associations of citizens. So a multinational, multi-billion dollar corporation is simply, quote, an association of citizens.
Sure.
And it goes right back to the 14th Amendment. Any rights held by an individual person, an individual citizen in the United States, are also held by corporations. So the Citizens United ruling that basically overthrew campaign finance reform was founded very solidly on the 14th Amendment and the later interpretation of the 14th Amendment by the courts.
Well, so wouldn't that open up corporations to have the same rights as individual citizens when it came to backing a candidate in any way? I mean, in terms of financial backing, for example?
Theoretically, and that was the argument that was made by the those who wanted to uphold the rights of Citizens United, the corporate rights to engage in political speech, as it was called, that, well, let's extend the logic of this. Mm-hmm. Any small business maybe that publishes a newsletter and mentions something about a political an election that's coming up, the government, you know, and if Big Brother could could move in and smash that, challenge that, drag them into court. All kinds of kind of nightmare scenarios were introduced, reinforcing the argument that free speech is absolutely sacred. The First Amendment is absolutely sacred. And any regulatory measures imposed on corporations spending in elections is therefore a terribly threatening violation, right, infringement of the First Amendment. Well, yes, it you know, you can make that argument if you wish, but I think at a certain point a kind of common sense factor comes into play, and in fact that argument, that point, was addressed directly by Justice Stevens, speaking for the minority, the four-member minority in the Citizens United case. Stevens writes, he has a very sort of down-to-earth way of expressing himself. At bottom, the court's opinion is thus a rejection of the common sense of the American people, who have recognized the need to prevent corporations from undermining self-government since the founding, and who have fought against the distinctive corrupting potential of corporate electioneering since the days of Theodore Roosevelt. It's a strange time to repudiate that common sense. While American democracy is imperfect, few outside the majority of this court would have thought its flaws included a dearth of corporate money in politics. So this kind of common sense voice of reason comes into play in Stevens' minority opinion. And when we speak of corporations and outside funding, I should stress that this is not all a matter of conservative business groups. It's also a matter of big unions. I mean, the money, the issue can be addressed from both sides of the political spectrum. It's not just a matter of left versus right. But it's a fascinating instance of following the progression of a legal principle over decades and decades. And here we have this decision now that has just come down in recent months.
Well, you have to wonder a little bit about how changing media would also change the influence that a corporation could have through this First Amendment channel. In other words, well, for example, if a corporation, and there are some good examples of this, if a corporation happened to have a media empire at its disposal, it could arguably not be restrained from all kinds of representations on behalf of one candidate or another.
Right. And you're just speaking theoretically in the abstract, of course. That's absolutely true. The nature of American politics has changed dramatically, not through any sinister means, but simply through technological change. You look back to the early years of the American Republic, it was a very direct kind of process. The candidate went out on the stump and made his case, and it was a he always in those days. And then, you know, in 1858, the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates for the U.S. Senate in Illinois, Lincoln and Douglas moving up and down the state, debating the issues of the day in great seriousness, newspaper reporters taking down their words and sending off the telegraph reports, and the debates were read throughout the country. What a change today, the era of television, moving into a television market, saturating the television waves with commercials which are, if not dishonest, at least
misleading
in many cases. And appeal to very, very make very, very simple kind of arguments, often very selectively focusing on some aspect of the candidate's record. This is really a kind of new era in which we are living in terms of American politics, and combining the power of the media with money flowing in from outside, from whatever source, has created very, very severe concerns about the nature of the democratic process. And one could argue that legislation like the McCain-Feingold Act and similar laws that were passed at the state level were an effort by, you know, the democratic legislative process to address those concerns. And now here we have the court going back to the First Amendment and saying, ah, no, can't do that. It violates the First Amendment as interpreted through the 14th Amendment to apply to corporations. So one of the ironies here is conservatives who profess to believe in going back to the Constitution, looking at the original intent of the legislators who adopted the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, is it conceivable that the Congress that adopted the Bill of Rights and laid out these freedoms and privileges of persons had in mind early 21st century America with multi-billion dollar corporations and extremely well-funded foundations of various political motives, moving into elections, buying television ads by thousands and thousands of dollars? It's a different world. And the idea that a kind of simple application of the First Amendment to contemporary American life will answer our problems, bypassing the legislature, bypassing Congress, which passed the McCain-Feingold Act, is really quite breathtaking when you think about it.
We'll look further at the implications of corporations as people when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Paul Boyer, and we're looking at the status of corporations in America. Are corporations persons? We've seen that the 14th Amendment and the First Amendment have been used as channels to indicate through the Supreme Court that indeed corporations are individuals in terms of some of the rights they have. But I have to wonder, I realize corporations seem to us to be maybe an outgrowth of the Industrial Revolution or something from 19th century American history. But are there precedents that go back before the U.S. Constitution having to do with the status of corporations?
Yes, there are. And that's one of the most fascinating aspects of this whole question is tracing it back historically. As I say, I'm not a legal historian. It's not my field. But as I got interested in this from my own experience in Dayton, growing up in Dayton, in fact, corporations emerged very early in Western history, and for a very early on, courts began to struggle with the question of what's the legal standing of these entities, groups of people, individuals coming together and creating this abstraction, and one of the most important early cases in common law occurred in England in 1612. It's called the Case of Sutton's Hospital, and it involves a man named Thomas Sutton, who was a wealthy mine owner in England and a moneylender apparently, and accumulated quite a large fortune. And along the way, he founded a hospital in London. Well, when he died, he, in his will, he left the bulk of his estate to this corporation, a charitable corporation, not a business corporation, but a charitable entity defined as a corporation. He left the bulk of his estate to this corporation. Well, his heirs, children and relatives, were unhappy. They thought the money should have come to them, so they brought suit. And they said, you can't leave money, you can't transfer property to an abstraction, a corporation. It has to go to an individual. And we're individuals and we want the money. So the case worked its way up and eventually came before the High Court of the Land, the Court of Exchequer. And the Chief Justice at that time was a man named Coke, Edward Coke. And he's widely regarded as sort of the great figure in early English common law history. And the court actually decided for – upheld the will. They said, yes, Thomas Sutton was in his rights in leaving the bulk of his estate to this charitable corporation that he had founded. But in the course of rendering his decision, we can see Edward Coke kind of struggling with this question of what exactly is the legal – what is a corporation? And what kind of rights does it have before the law? And here's a bit from his decision. Now, this is early 17th century language, so you have to kind of make that translation to the past. But you can see in the process of this how he's kind of trying to think it through. Coke writes in 1612, "How can a hospital be sufficient to support the name of an incorporation when the corporation itself is only in abstracto? A corporation, aggregate of many, is invisible, immortal, and resteth only in consideration of the law, and therefore cannot have predecessor nor successor. They may not commit treason, nor be outlawed, nor excommunicate. For they have no souls, neither can they appear in person, but by attorney. A corporation, aggregate of many, cannot do fealty, for an invisible body cannot be in person, nor can swear. It is not subject to imbecilities or death of the natural body." So it's fascinating to see Coke, 400 years ago, trying to work through this question that the Supreme Court in 2010 was still grappling with, and five-member majority in Citizens United said, oh, yes, corporations are simply associations of people. Therefore, they have all the rights of persons under the First Amendment.
Well, you can see how he had wrestled with some of those issues. For example, inheritance. If you're thinking about individuals, it's straightforward enough for a father to leave his estate to his children or child. But a corporation, if it dissolves, which would be the corporate equivalent of death, where does the money go?
That's true, and that's supported a lot of lawyers over the years of trying to anticipate possible contingencies. And when you look at wills that have been drawn up by lawyers, if the person is leaving money to a corporation, that would be a nonprofit, a philanthropic corporation, entity of some kind, you will frequently see an addition to the will that says something like, if this institution ceases to fulfill the obligations that it is presently committed to, this bequest shall be void, or if this corporation is dissolved and ceases to exist, the funds shall be transferred to. So there's this effort to deal with the gap between leaving funds to an individual. Of course, the will in that case says if this individual is deceased at the time of this bequest is probated, the funds shall go to, and then
right.
Some other name is given or some other disposition of it. So lawyers and jurists over the years have tried to struggle with this corporation problem. The examples we're talking about here are personal bequests. What becomes interesting as a civic question is what are the political and public policy implications of defining corporations as persons?
Well, for example, I mean, even more important than the bequest, I suppose, more relevant of late would be what if a corporation commits a crime?
Right.
How is a corporation held accountable?
Right. Well, this raises really a kind of very basic question that we're beginning to hear more and more now, I think. And that is, if we accept the logic or if we accept the legal reasoning of the courts that under the law corporations are persons when it comes to the First Amendment rights and privileges, are there any obligations that go with that? Corporations enjoy these privileges.
These benefits of citizenship.
The benefits of personhood, and yet when it comes to the obligations that we normally associate with being a citizen, an upstanding member of the community, somehow the argument fades away.
Well, I mean, the corporation could simply dissolve, couldn't it, if there were some accountability, whereas a person presumably wouldn't have that option. It could dissolve and reform somewhere else.
Dissolve, declare bankruptcy to avoid judgments. That we hear of this all the time. I was struck just a few months ago. In The Economist magazine. If you're familiar with The Economist, it's a British magazine. Its origins are in the British liberal tradition, and liberalism in this context means free market liberalism, freedom from government regulation. And The Economist is generally thought of and is a sort of pro-business publication. But there was a really interesting column in The Economist last March that addressed this very question. And the author said, these artificial persons, that is corporations, have always provoked worries. Aren't they likely to invoke the rights of ordinary people without burdening themselves with the responsibilities? You don't have to be a radical to worry about the might of organizations that can live forever and take up residence in dozens of countries at once. Why should the idea of corporate personhood only cut one way? If companies enjoy the same rights as flesh and blood humans, then shouldn't they be under the same obligations? The conservative majority, he's talking about the Citizens United case, the conservative majority on the Supreme Court is in danger of digging a trap for itself, strengthening the arguments of people who insist that companies have a moral duty to pursue social rather than merely business ends. So a kind of interesting perspective from not a radical leftist at all, a conservative business magazine.
It does make you wonder how those responsibilities could be interpreted through the Constitution or somehow enforced legally.
It is a question, I think, in a very real one. In a way, I think probably what we're talking about here is more in the political realm than in the constitutional and judicial realm. How do you force a corporation to be morally responsible?
Right.
That raises all kinds of problematic issues. But as a political strategy, in terms of the issues we're addressing now, in terms of BP in the Gulf,
yes,
corporate disasters that can be laid at the door of corporate behavior, or even issues of taxation, fairness in taxation, comment that the person made in Iowa to Mitt Romney that elicited his response, corporations are people, my friend, the comment was tax corporations, raise taxes on corporations. So do corporations have the same – is there a kind of obligation, social obligation, not enforceable by law or criminal statute, but a kind of sense of propriety that if corporations are enjoying all of these benefits, do they not then have certain responsibilities that follow along from that?
And how would you enforce those if you do – I mean ethics aside and social conscience aside, how would you legislate or somehow enforce those positives, if you want to call them that, you know, the obligations, the moral obligations, if you will, of a corporation?
It's a difficult question. You can't simply use a sledgehammer approach and say here hence to forward all corporations will behave in a morally responsible way. It has the nature of the law is it addresses specific situations and specific
as they come up.
And I think this question of corporate responsibility, if corporations enjoy legal privileges, what kind of obligations go with that? That question becomes directly relevant in a whole range of issues involving regulation of behavior, corporate behavior, environmental standards, safety standards, this whole range of the regulatory law that a number of corporate and business interests are very upset about and are constantly criticizing. Regulation, government regulation.
Yeah, stifling growth, etc. The corporate contribution to the economy.
Yeah, there you see this debate laid out in very clear terms. We want the privileges that are associated that the courts have granted us into the protections, the First Amendment protections, the other protections that the courts have granted us. But when it comes to the kind of regulation that are imposed on individual behavior, when those are applied to corporate behavior, somehow this becomes a dangerous government intrusion in the free market.
Well, we'll see if we can separate out some of the responsibility from the privileges that corporations get as they have this legal status of individuals. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Paul Boyer, and we're looking at the status of corporations. Are corporations people? And if so, what are their rights and what are their responsibilities if they have citizenship in the same way that an individual would have? This all goes back, Paul, you tell us, to this constitutional, the 14th Amendment, saying that corporations as groups of people have the rights of individuals. Wouldn't it apply, though, again, to something like a union? What would be the difference between a corporation and a union in terms of their individual, their status as individuals?
Right. That's an excellent point. Of course, the 14th Amendment itself did not define corporations as persons, but later decisions by the courts. When we speak about corporations, of course, we immediately think of business corporations, but in fact, it's a quite broad term applying to organizations of all kinds, including labor unions. So this whole debate is not simply a matter of bashing big business or bashing corporate America in the way that term is usually used. It involves entities, whether corporate business corporations, labor unions, other organizations entirely that represent great accumulations of funds that they have available to pursue their purposes. And these funds, these big interventions in the electoral process can come from all across the political spectrum, including labor unions and other organizations founded to pursue particular cultural or social or moral agendas, whatever it might be. So this debate is not absolutely not simply a matter of somehow trying to rein in the power of business corporations.
But it does sound as if, as we get into an election year, that there could be some real questioning as to the power of a corporation on one hand or a union on the other hand to, let's say, get involved in the election.
I think that's really the concern that has given rise to the whole issue today is this sense that somehow the electoral process, sort of the engagement of the voters with a particular candidate in a particular state or local jurisdiction, is being warped and distorted by outside interest groups that can pour enormous – from whatever source – can pour enormous sums of money into this, as we mentioned before, this media-saturated world and buy up, so much television time and kind of swamp the process sometimes at the last minute before there's an opportunity or a response. So I think inevitably what starts out as a kind of constitutional legal question becomes enmeshed in politics and concerns about the state of American civic life very quickly.
Madison, Wisconsin, which occasionally takes on the mantle of an independent country, I believe has held a referendum involving the status of corporations.
Yeah. In Madison earlier this year, there was a special election to fill a vacancy on the Supreme Court. It was just broader than Madison. But in Madison, attached to that election was a referendum, non-binding referendum item that said, resolved, only human beings, not corporations, are entitled to constitutional rights. Well, it passed by 84%. I doubt very much that this is going to be adopted as a constitutional amendment, but I think it is a kind of straw in the wind suggesting rising levels of concern about the nature of America's civic health and the electoral process in an era of mass media saturation and enormous sums of money pouring into local and state elections from the outside. And I don't think we're anywhere near resolving that question, but it seems to me it's rising to the surface with much more urgency these days.
You can play a few mind games, though, can't you, if you take the status of corporations to an extreme? Like any kind of logical premise, you can extend it beyond logic?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've found myself, sort of imagining, well, if corporations really are persons, how would we evaluate some of the corporate behavior that we see? Certainly, in some cases, I think we would admire the person, quote, the person. I mentioned earlier the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. That's on a global scale. But also there are individual communities where local businesses, local corporations still clearly have a very strong civic sense. So in talking about NCR and these multinationals that pull up roots and ignore their local roots, the local communities, that's not the whole story. Certainly the sense of corporate civic obligation is very real and still exists and needs to be applauded when it occurs. But the other side of the story is part of it as well. And so some corporations, if they were persons, we'd admire them and praise them. Others, we might think, wow, that's really kind of nasty, kind of a nasty person. And others might be imprisoned in psychopathic institutions.
Yes, if they live that long.
If they
certain corporations have managed to collapse before they get to the incarceration point.
Right.
Well, we do tend to, I suppose, forget that corporations like people exhibit a vast range of size and power.
That's absolutely true, and I think it's important to keep the complexity of these questions in mind as well as some of the broader issues.
So if we go back to Dayton, still feeling the loss of NCR, NCR pulled out completely, and the symbol that you gave was just perfect of that, was a library facade.
It was an auditorium. Yeah, the New York Times photograph of this wrecked building that kind of epitomized for me the whole, you know, I was thinking of my high school graduation and marching in there and the pride and the citizens who were gathered there, and now it's all gone. And in the case of Dayton and NCR, it was the resentment was intensified by the current head of the corporation who right up to near the end made statements to the local papers, "We're committed to Dayton, our roots are in Dayton." He was lying. He was just saying what they wanted to hear at the moment. And then within a few months, the final it was a drawn out process. NCR withdrew some of its facilities, but maintained its corporate headquarters in Dayton for a period of time. And then finally, just a few years ago, NCR left Dayton completely. And their last economic contribution to the city was to hire a truck to transport their corporate records to the local historical society. So the last survival of NCR in Dayton is now their corporate records, which can be consulted in the local historical society.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Yes, in diminished proportions, unfortunately.
But there must be still hundreds of, as you say, communities that are still benefiting from a deep-rooted relationship with a corporation.
That's true. Often it's the first generation of the family, a corporation, that feels that particular commitment. Sometimes it diminishes with successive generations. But here in Madison, we can certainly think of a number of examples of corporations that have shown an enormous commitment to the local community. And I'm sure this would be true throughout the state and indeed throughout the country.
So did Dayton. Has Dayton recovered from the loss of NCR?
It's struggling. It's very much struggling. It wasn't just NCR, but it was part of the whole deindustrialization Rust Belt phenomenon that other big corporations in the city withdrew. Delco was there, big auto parts manufacturing company. Frigidaire, they're all gone.
All gone.
So it's a story that you see all over industrial America these days. NCR wasn't entirely responsible for the economic problems that Dayton is facing today.
Well, it's going to be an issue that will be very much with us, not just in this coming election year, but after that too, as corporations continue to go multinational and the question of their status as individuals and citizens with rights and responsibilities continues to develop. Paul Boyer, thanks for joining me for this hour.
It's been a pleasure, Norman. Thank you.
We'll look forward to your next visit. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join Emily Auerbach and me for the next hour of University of the Year.